Welcome to another edition of Awaken Life. I'm your host, Adam Seward, and today, again, I feel very privileged to be talking to one of my personal heroes, is someone who I spent a lot of time with his work when I was in graduate school in particular, and he's the author of a number of books, but and I'd like to just give you a little more background. He's a professor of psychiatry and philosophy, as well as anthropology, and an adjunct professor of religious studies at the University of California at Irvine. And his publications include The State of the Integral Art, and a book that I spent some time with was Essential Spirituality, The Seven Central Practices, and The World of Shamanism. And he's also a teacher of The Course in Miracles, which many of you know I'm very fond of and spend a lot of time with. And I'm just feel very blessed to have him on the show today. Roger, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me, Adam.
I've spent a lot of time with your work, and I'm a great fan of it, and it's definitely helped me along the path. And I'm excited today to share some of your insight and some of that wisdom with our listeners. And you and I talked before we came on about a potential topic for today, and you're aware that the show is really focused on helping people to live an awakened life, and that, you know, waking up to who they truly are and then showing up as that in the world. And we thought maybe we could use some things from The Course in Miracles and talk a bit about that and how that can be applied to helping that happen as a tool, and then also ethics, what you might think of as Buddhist precepts, in the sense of, you know, really living ethically, and we can probably define some of what that means, because I know that's a topic that is of interest to listeners. So if it's okay with you, does that sound like a good topic?
That should keep us all busy.
A little bit broad, but I think there's a lot certainly that I'm curious to talk to you about in both of those fields.
Sure. Well, let's play.
Okay. So tools for living enlightenment is kind of the title or the thought that I had behind this. The Course in Miracles, I know for you, is a tool that you've used, and you actually wrote a book called or were co-authored a book called Gifts from A Course in Miracles. Which is something that I've taken from. I'm just curious about, how did that come into being? How was it that you came to create that and offer that?
Yeah, actually, thanks, Adam. Well, actually, I should just nuance that slightly, and that is, I didn't author that book. My wife, Frances Vaughan, and I co-edited it, mm-hmm. and what it actually consists of is a collection of poetic excerpts from A Course in Miracles, which, of course, is far more profound and extraordinary document than I could certainly write. But,
well, sure, yeah. Well, and even the people who wrote it didn't take credit for writing it, so...
That's true. So, but anyway... my wife and I have been studying the course for over 30 years together now, and like any profound, truly profound spiritual text, it's bottomless. Each mm-hmm. time you go through it, you just discover further depths in it and in yourself, and it opens further understandings and possibilities. So out of those years of working with it, we have found it to be invaluable in so many areas of life, from some of the dimensions you mentioned your show focuses on, that is the moving in the direction of awakening, and also, of course, providing some psychological and spiritual insights and refining one's way of, or assisting one to refine one's way in the world. Over the years, as we just... read through it and worked with it and studied it, we just found excerpts that were particularly spoke to us and were particularly appealing and poetic, and just excerpted those and put them together with a little introduction and made them available. The idea being that the course, as you and probably many of your listeners know, is an extraordinarily profound document, but it can be a little intimidating for people who don't know it to just take off the shelf.
Yes.
So we thought this might be an introduction for some people.
Yeah. Well, and part of what I appreciate about it is that it's organized by topic. So, you know, you could look up what does the course have to say about love, or what does the course have to say about fear, and you have all of the, well, you have different quotes that relate specifically to those things. It sounds like that was probably part of the way that you were trying to make some of this more accessible to people.
Yeah, I think that it just made sense to organize the topic. The course itself is you certainly know, and probably most of the people listening in know, is three separate volumes. One is a text which lays out the thought system. The other is a little teacher's manual. And the third is a workbook with a lesson for each day of the year. And, you know, it's those combined add up to over 1,100 pages. So there's a lot of material, an extraordinary number of ideas, and some very profound insights in there. But it's kind of written like a symphony. All these ideas and themes weave together and return in different with different flavors and motifs and depths, so that it is a little hard as you go through it to separate out what the course says, for, as you mentioned, about fear or love or relationship. So one of the things that Gifts from A Course in Miracles does is, as you say, provide topical excerpts and for people who are interested in either getting a taste of the course or getting a sense of what it might say about specific topics and issues, then it gives a taste. And, of course, there's no way a few excerpts, no matter how poetic and profound, can do justice to something as... it was a kind of symphonic whole and a very profound one at that, as the Course in Miracles is, but still, it gives a taste, and that was the idea. And if the book moves people to go to the original, then that's just fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I'm sure for many, you know, it has, and I think that it stands alone as well as a wonderful tool, both for facilitating awakening and for you know, helping people to live it. Some people make the distinction that it's more in the realm of translation than transformation, in the sense that it's, you know, it's giving you another view of reality versus giving you a specific practice to integrate that view, but I guess at the same time you could say that that's what the workbook does. I'm just curious what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I would take a different tack on that. I would say that the course not only offers transformational practices, but is very rare among spiritual traditions in offering if we use the Hindu framework of the yogas, all the major yogas, that is, you know, Hinduism speaks of course it has many yogas, but the four major yogas are usually spoken of as jnana yoga, the yoga of the intellect, bhakti, the yoga of love and devotion, raja, the yoga of meditation, and kama yoga, the yoga of work and action in the world. And the course really employs all of those, and very skillfully. It really is the course doesn't seem to be particularly interested. In fact, it's very clear. It's not something you just read and have a nice thoughts about. Although though it does work with thoughts and the transformation of ideas, but it's very much a practical. It's designed as a very practical tool to be applied in each and every moment, each and every relationship, particularly relationships. And one of the unique things about the course, which is very intriguing, is that it's the only practice my wife and I have found in our study of the world's traditions which uses peer relationship as its primary focus for awakening.
Yes,
there are traditions such as bhakti yoga, for example, or devotional aspects of several traditions which use the relationship to God, love and devotion of God, or love and devotion of one's teacher or guru. But we found nothing else which primarily focuses on peer relationships, which is a very interesting thing, and it makes makes it wonderful to do with someone you're very close to.
Yes, yeah. Well, and it you know, continually talking about your brother, you know, that both you know the voice of the Course, which defines himself as Jesus, talking to you as his brother, and also talking to you about, you know, your relationship with your brother as the key to your, both to him and to the sonship, you know, other elements of the sonship as the key to salvation. And that's a really interesting point that, yeah, that's one of, if not the only, one of the few texts that really points to that brother to brother relationship as the, you know, the key to enlightenment or salvation or coming home, as the Course often puts it.
There's certainly, I think, all the great traditions emphasize the importance of you know, kind of do unto others, etc. But that focus on peer relationship, and within that, particularly the practice of forgiveness, a unique aspect of the Course, because we should nuance that by acknowledging that Christianity is unique among great traditions with its emphasis on forgiveness. It's one of the great strengths of the tradition, but the Course adds a unique psychological understanding of the levels of forgiveness and the practice of forgiveness and psychology and power of it. So it brings further depth to one's appreciation of that practice. And for me, I don't know about for you, but when I first got into the Course, I thought, oh, you know, just forgive. That's just too simple. And then I tried doing it. Of course, it turns out,
right,
as always, simple doesn't mean easy. You know,
yes.
It's like meditation. You know, just focus on the breath. What's simple? Well, yeah, right.
Right, these simple practices are often lifetimes of, like you said, bottomless practices.
And one of the things you find is that simple can also be very profound and does not necessarily mean easy.
No.
Exactly, as you're saying, and these are usually lifetime practices.
Yes. Well, and one of the things that I've run into with the Course that has been an interesting challenge, in a sense, is that it's so direct that your complete freedom and your complete release is available right now. I mean, you know, it's constantly talking about how you've come to the end. This is the end. The journey ends here. And yet, I've been studying the Course for, you know, 10 years. So, you know, there's almost a sense of, well, you know, I mean, there are these moments where you feel completely free, but then you can also look at it as, you know, am I not getting it? Because, you know, it still seems that, you know, I'm still studying it.
Sure. Yeah. And it's that paradox that the great contemplative traditions point us to the fact that freedom is found in this moment, but we're not particularly good at being in this moment. So, I think in some ways that's how should we put this? It's the Course in some ways gives, and I assume deliberately, gives what seems like an overly optimistic gloss on on the ease of awakening.
Yes.
And you know, that's not the, one sees that occasionally in other places too. And I think from an awakened stance, then yes, there's that recognition that there's nothing to do, there's nowhere to go, and it's right here now. But busy minds, to say both are true. It's right here now, there's nothing to do, etc., and our mind's very busy doing.
Yes.
So, as the Course says, yes, there's nothing to do, but since you can't just be, here are some things that will bring you more into the present moment, and
Yes.
so go forth and practice.
Yes.
And of course, that's a common theme with, there's the concept of always already, that we are always already that which we are seeking. Freedom is always already available to us,
Yes.
but our busy minds have a hard time releasing and relaxing and dissolving into that. So, okay, so we practice,
Yes.
and for most of us, that practice is lifelong.
Yes. And I love the way that you do hold that paradox, because it's a real delicate art, that, to move between these, these seemingly contradictory opposites, while, very, and at least in the relative, very much contradictory opposites. And I just imagine, I don't know if you come up against this, or meet this, I should say, in your work, but people sort of working to hold the same paradox of, wait, I don't have to do anything. Everything's perfect as it is. But yet there is a way to act that's somehow better, or there is a way to live that is somehow more evolved.
Yeah, and Suzuki Roshi of San Francisco Zen Center probably put it as skillfully as anyone. He said, "You are perfect just the way you are, and you could use some improvement." So, the Dzogchen tradition of Tibetan Buddhism has a very nice perspective on that, which I quote the words of Suryadas, a teacher in that tradition who I've learned a great deal from. And he says, practice is to swoop down from above with the view that while climbing up from below using relative practices. And so the, unpacking that, it's, you hold that absolute view or what Tibetans call pure perception as fully as you can, while and with the recognition that, yes, from an absolute perspective, there's nothing that needs doing, perfection is, while simultaneously doing the relative practices that refine and hone and stabilize and deepen and actualize the mind, so that we can come to a fuller, more stable recognition of that view.
And these tools and practices, for the course, that would be the workbook, but you've come up with some of your own. I mean, this has been a focus of your work, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, and I just nuanced what you said, Adam, agreeing, and that is, it's not that I came up with my own. It's more that one of my great interests has been to take advantage of this extraordinary opportunity we have in our generation, where for the first time in history, all the world's spiritual traditions and practices are available to us. And
Yes.
so, for the first time, we have the opportunity of seeing what the great minds and sages and saints of history and across the world and throughout all cultures and contexts have regarded as what are the great values of human life, what are the possibilities we can arise to or awaken to, and what are the means for doing so. And so we have for the first time this opportunity of taking the what the great minds throughout history have recommended and looking at what they have in common. And so it's a very interesting question. What are the greatest saints and sages throughout history agreed on as the most important qualities to cultivate and the most important practices with which to do so?
It's that's all the information's available, and in many ways you've worked to synthesize it. And it's really the other thing that is sort of interesting about our time that we live in, is that, the evolutionary impulse is waking up to itself, and actively participating in its own evolution, so to speak. In many ways, would you say, well, I could just ask you, would you say that your work has been aimed at aligning with that impulse in order to offer these tools from the ages, the sort of the best of the best, to those that are interested in accelerating their own evolution?
Well, I get a little overwhelmed by that scope. I think evolution is a big process. It's been going on for 13 billion years. So I love trying to understand what's going on, et cetera. At the same time, I think, it's a way bigger picture than I can comprehend. So I think what my motivation more in trying to pull these ideas together, which primarily, I guess, what you're primarily referring to here is essential spirituality, the seven central practices, where I tried to look at what great minds in all the traditions had said were the most important practices. For me, it felt like, okay, well, I want to know for myself, and I'd like to make available in an accessible manner or accessible way what these great people have recommended as practices and try to make them available and make sense of them for people, and also legitimize them, say, here are what the great minds recommend, so maybe we ought to pay attention, and also present them in a way that was, fairly accessible. So I think the motivation was more along those kind of very practical lines, and if in a picture bigger than I can comprehend, then it aligns with some sort of evolutionary process, then wonderful.
Well, and I should remind readers too that one of your books is called Paths Beyond Ego, and or one of the books you've contributed to, which part of what I appreciate about your approach is the that sort of transpersonal approach. And so, in a sense, maybe I'm pointing more to a transpersonal agent, that's involved in that process. But I also, appreciate that for you, it was more, a more practical sort of, whether you were in alignment with I mean, in one sense, we could say, of course, you were in line with an evolutionary impulse, but whether that was your subjective experience of it in the moment.
That makes sense.
And I appreciate too, this kind of leads into discussion on ethics, because that's really really seems to be a way of addressing sort of the relative side of things. And a lot of people, I think, are asking the questions, like, well, what, once they've sort of evolved beyond the, more conventional right and wrong, black and white sort of modes of ethics, there's not a lot sometimes not a lot of access to more post-conventional forms of ethics. And I know that that's been, you've given presentations on that and written about that as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma you hit when you start looking at what ethics really means. As you say, beyond conventional levels, and that most of the ethical, most of the ethics we have is a pretty, in society anyway, is pretty much conventional. And then, of course, in the spiritual traditions, it gets. In religion itself, one has various levels of ethics up to the contemplative perspectives, which are really transpersonal or definitely transconventional. For myself, I find it useful to look at several levels of ethics and and I guess I would define, first off, let me just back up and say that, and ask, maybe we can explore the question, well, what exactly is it that's ethical? Is an action ethical? And I, to cut a long story short, my own conclusion is that what ethical refers to is our intentions.
Mm-hmm.
That is that, you know, you can look at the same action can be ethical or unethical depending on the intention behind it. So for me, the focus of ethics is really on intentions. And we could say that an intention is ethical to the extent that it does certain things at each specific developmental levels. At the physical, social level, we could say an intention is ethical to the extent it reduces suffering and enhances well-being for everyone.
Mm.
At the mental level, an intention is ethical to the extent that it reduces destructive mind states, emotions, and enhances helpful ones. So an intention is ethical to the extent, for example, that we intend to, for example, release anger and hatred and cultivate feelings of well-being and love, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Yes.
At the subtle level, an intention is ethical to the extent that it reduces illusion. And at the causal level, or the unmanifest level, I'd say, an intention is ethical to the extent that it fosters awareness of and identification with awareness.
Mm.
And then at a non-dual level, of course, we're getting up pretty stratospheric here.
Yes.
I think that an intention is ethical to the extent that it maintains fosters recognition of the spiritual or divine nature of all phenomena.
Mm, yes.
And it's interesting, for example, in Tibetan Buddhism, this is what's called pure vision, that is seeing all things as in the spiritual dimension or divine nature of all things. And that for very advanced yogis, one of their samayas or ethical commitments is to maintain pure vision.
Oh, wow.
And that's a pretty high level
yes.
ethical commitment.
Yes.
I don't know anyone who keeps it. Maybe the Dalai Lama does, maybe some other
yes.
other types do. I can see the potential, but it's so far beyond anything I could hope to maintain that I can only bow in admiration that that is an aspiration for advanced practitioners. So, but it make that kind of spectrum view or developmental view or looking at what ethics means at different levels at least kind of gives a taste of some of the possibilities at post-conventional and trans-conventional levels.
It sure does. And I mean, in a sense, each of those levels is a potential for each of us. And I imagine that sometimes we... You know, an individual is moving between those levels in terms of what their center of gravity might be. So, you know, where on a really good day, it feels like you want to maintain, maintain pure vision. On another day, you're just, hoping to not do any harm.
that sounds right to me. well said.
Yeah.
Well said.
And I just, for me personally, I would say that there are some questions around how to balance that, from day to day, because, what was right yesterday might not be right today.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a very important recognition. And of course, some of the implications are that, traditional conventional ethics emphasizes behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Do this, don't do that, which is very important. And it's an absolute foundation for an ethical life. But it gets a little tricky because if your understanding of ethics is only about following behavioral rules, then it doesn't point to the other levels we've been discussing,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't encourage us to, as you said, on our best, better days, look to, for example, refining our mind states or cutting through the illusions we may recognize, or fostering identification with awareness. Those just aren't part of the conventional behavioral orientation towards ethics.
Yeah, and it, but yeah, and it's you know, if you think in terms of transcend and include, it's kind of just that navigating the territory of, okay, I want to do this because I feel like it's helping me to you know, to awaken, to identify more with awareness, to cultivate compassion. Yet I'm aware that by doing this, there will be this negative potentially negative behavioral consequence that would be expressed on another level. And then, and then the paradox of that, I mean, that's where my mind goes, of the paradox of that, and the tension of those two levels.
And ideally, and again, we're emphasizing ideally, and one skillful behavior, and I would define skillful behavior as that which fosters the well-being of everyone, including oneself.
Yeah.
Skillful behavior is sensitive to multiple levels and congruent with, again, ideally, optimally congruent on all levels. But, of course, we are once again going back to an important point you raised, that these are lifelong practices, and ethics is truly a very demanding practice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, we tend to think of, you know, just shape up and be ethical, but but we don't realize it's really a very demanding yoga. And, you know, I mean, for example, just trying to tell the truth, you know, or as you practice right speech, as the Buddha summarize it, and it's the best summary of good speech I've found in any tradition. It's succinct to say only what is true and helpful.
Yes.
Well, yep. You know, I mean, that's in just a few words encapsulates volumes, and yet trying that as a daily practice, saying only what is true and helpful, that's a challenge.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but I try to do that, and then every now and then I open my mouth, and next thing I know, well, wait on, that wasn't true.
Oh, I have a fun time with it. I mean, sometimes I'll be sitting with a client, and I'll go on for, you know, a minute or so, and then I'll stop, and they'll say, "You really think it's that way?" And I'll just go, "No." No, actually, about halfway through that, I started to become aware that this was not true, what I was saying, and... I'll throw it out there anyway, just to kind of see sometimes, you know, where it lands. But yes, I mean, so no, you know, even with the best of intentions, sometimes I find myself saying things that are not true and definitely not helpful.
Yeah. And it's a very humbling process, but then all these practices are humbling.
They are.
You know, I mean, the problem with religion and spirituality and all these practices, they're done by human beings.
Yes.
So, which places grave limitations on what you can expect from them.
Yes. And humility, I mean, is that a virtue that you focus on in any of your books?
Oh, yes. I aspire to be known for my humility.
Yes. I sort of asked that kind of already knowing the answer, but.
Right. Let's see. It's not one of the primary ones, but it's certainly acknowledged as important by, you know, in multiple traditions. But I think we need to disambiguate some things here, because humility is so often confused with unworthiness, guilt, for example.
Yes.
Kind of pathological, what should we call them? I guess the closest thing would be facsimiles of real humility.
Yes.
And I guess, a high level humility would be, as the meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein once said, the absence of anyone to be humble, which
Yes.
is a I thought was a pretty nice definition.
Pretty humble definition.
Right. And a pretty high level one.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a practice to recognize, again, as part of right speech, to notice each time you're saying something which comes out of, trying to aggrandize yourself or make yourself look good or whatever.
Yes. Yeah, it's and things like guilt and blame are really a part of a lower level of ethics, and part it seems like going into a more mature or higher level of ethics is m learning to manage and transcend probably things like guilt and blame and shame.
Yeah, I think you're right. And again, the course, as the Course in Miracles has a very profound treatment of guilt, and probably the most sophisticated I've seen in any tradition. And certainly, as far as I can understand, guilt is seems hardwired into us, very important and appropriate at certain stages, but then at other stages, really more destructive than helpful. As far as I can see, guilt is, there's a distinction, useful distinction, I think, between guilt and regret. Regret is, comes from the recognition that something that one has done has not been skillful or helpful. But guilt is regret plus self-attack. And self-attack doesn't seem particularly helpful to anyone.
I think the course refers to like sin as adjustment, for example. So rather than sin being something that's wrong with you to be blamed for, it's just just a place where there an adjustment could be made. And sometimes it also refers it defines sin as error instead of instead of sin, where an error can be corrected.
Right,
And then
yeah,
it goes
nicely
on to
put.
say it's ultimate all that's ultimately all an illusion anyway, which is pretty ultimately forgiving. But yeah.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. I'm glad you brought that up, Adam, between sin and error, because sin has an element of evil, bad judgment, condemnation to it. An error is, oh, that wasn't helpful.
Yes.
What can I learn from this? What can I do differently?
Yes.
And sin leads to suffering, both in the other person you see it in, and in yourself.
Yes.
But error leads to, basically asks for correction and help,
Yes.
and they're different. I think it's they're basically looking at the same act from different perspectival points with very, very different implications and possibilities and effects.
Certainly, yeah. And where one is, well, I'm sure you're aware that part of like the cycle of addiction, for example, is shame and guilt. And where when a person goes into that believing somehow that they're doing something to help themselves, to stop the behavior, I'm going to shame myself out of this addiction, then they end up back, of course, using again or repeating the behavior, whereas things like admit in some recovery models you have things like admittance as like the first stage of recovery, where basically you're just going into that place of awareness of what is happening without the judgment and without the condemnation.
Yeah, and there's something I don't quite understand about the guilt and shame in recovery, but somehow seems very important, and that is, it seems like the person who can use guilt and shame as a justification for using again. It's like,
Yes.
I feel, oh, I'm so bad, so I might as well go and use again, or whatever.
Yeah.
It almost like it becomes an excuse and justification in some way.
Yes, yeah, it's, I'm a bad person, or there's something wrong with me, and so therefore, I should be, continuing this, which is also has a lot of flavors of, the victim energy and the sense of powerlessness and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, that sounds right. I don't quite. I feel like I don't quite fully understand this, but it also feels very important somehow.
Yes. And one thing I believe I heard you say in a discussion around ethics was that, and this is, I think you were referring to higher level ethics, and I'm not sure if it was the highest or not, but this idea of sort of doing good because of nirvana, and that because of the show, the idea of the show is awakened life, and we talk often about things like nirvana and samadhi and satori and all that. I thought maybe you could just clarify what does it mean to do good because of nirvana?
Well, you've got me. I don't remember saying
Well, yeah, it was a video. You were with Ken Wilber, and you guys were talking about ethics. Yeah,
I don't remember.
it sounds very
And
similar to the doing good in order to the ethical intention of maintaining right view, or pure vision, as you called it.
Yeah, well, I don't know what I don't remember what I said, and I don't know about that, but I do. Certainly, ethics is ethics in its mature forms merges into service and contribution, and so the distinction between the two
Yes.
starts to dissolve because ethics is basically a way of ensuring positive relationships with and contribution to others. But as one practices ethics, the motive matures from firstly, let me not screw up to wanting the well-being of others, and that, of course, just flows into service and contribution and altruism.
Yeah. Which is, like you said, sort of the ultimate practice of ethics, which is also how the course would, I believe, define, the truly ethical life, which is, of love and forgiveness and service towards your brother.
Yeah, and so certainly, as you implied, service is a culminating point or direction of ethics, and also, and not only of ethics in essential spirituality, the seven central practices. One of the things that really struck me was that each and every one of the great traditions emphasizes service and contribution. In some ways, almost as a culminating practice, emphasizing that you don't do these practices just for yourself alone. If you think you're doing these practices, whether it's transforming emotions or developing attention, concentration, or cultivating wisdom, if you think you're doing them for yourself alone, that's not a particularly high-level understanding. That's and it's counterproductive because in reality you're not alone and you're not separate. And whatever you do to yourself as both the course and Ramana Maharshi of Hinduism and the Buddha and who knows how many other people emphasize whatever
Yes.
you do to others, you do to yourself. So sooner or later you wake up to the idea that all these practices flower into contribution and service to others as a kind of culminating point in practice.
Yes.
And so service is in some way the peak or the final common end point of all these practices.
Yes, yeah. Which you see in, like, whether if you were looking at the story of Jesus, for example, where he begins his ministry, after 40 days in the desert, or some of these other teachers, the Buddha, that, for example, that begins teaching the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path after his time under the Bodhi tree.
Yeah, and there's what the historian Arnold Toynbee called the cycle of withdrawal and return, which is common to many sages, both religious founders and many of the great figures in each of the great traditions. That is, that these people have there's a common thread to their life cycle, and it's as you described that they live in the conventional world for a while, but then the suffering, the existential issues and questions tug at them so deeply that eventually they withdraw from conventional society, turn attention inward, often use a variety of spiritual practices, whether it's fasting in solitude as Jesus did, or meditation as the Buddha did, or prayer and isolation as Muhammad did, etc., etc. Whatever the practice, they basically turn attention inward to wrestle with these great foundational questions of life. And having come to some illumination, then they return to help and heal and teach others. And so that cycle, withdrawal and return, is one of the great common threads of the great saints and sages.
Yes, and you, speaking of sort of being away, you were just at a retreat recently. You just came back, is
I
that right?
was.
Yeah. And
Yes,
how
yes.
what was the focus of that retreat?
Well, I had the good fortune of being at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Northern California, which is a truly exquisite meditation center. And I was doing, at this retreat, I was doing Dzogchen, which is a Tibetan Buddhist practice, a very, like so many practices, simple but
Yes.
profound practice. In this case,
Yes.
just resting without actively doing or interfering with the mind in any way, and at least in moments, hopefully resting in awareness itself, with the understanding that that kind of resting in awareness is in its own is by itself a very transformative and healing process. Of course, an awful lot of time is spent not resting in awareness,
Right,
but
right.
being jostled around by the mind and its insanity. But of course, you learn from that too. But and any retreat is a wonderful opportunity to remove oneself from the busyness and distractions of life, to turn attention inward, to open to the questions that really matter. What really matters in life? What really matters in my life?
Yes.
What's worth doing, what's worth pursuing, and simply to have that time and that quiet and a wonderfully supportive and beautiful natural environment in which to open to these questions is it's not always easy, but it's always valuable.
Yes. Well, and when you come back from something like that, it I can just tell that you're bringing a certain depth of abiding awareness with you, it feels like. And just even as you were talking about that, I just felt myself just, sensing that, tuning into that. And where did you do it by yourself, or?
No, Spirit Rock puts on retreats for the public, and anyone can go. And I'd certainly recommend anyone who's interested in checking out the website for Spirit Rock Meditation Center.
Yes.
They have retreats throughout the year; anyone can go. This was a one of the longer retreats, and I was there for 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So there are about between 80 and 90 people there, but it's done in silence, and so you have the best of both worlds. There's silence and a certain sense of solitude, but you also have the support of a community and a staff that are very dedicated to, for example, providing food and support and making sure you don't have to be bothered by anything other than doing your practice. So it's a truly extraordinary setting and opportunity for spiritual reflection and meditation and practice.
Certainly, certainly. And were there any insights or anything that came from your time there that you'd be willing to share?
Let's see. Adam, it's always a little difficult to separate out and just announce a particular insight
Yes,
because
yes.
apart from a context, it doesn't have much meaning. I would say that one of the things that was a gift of the but I will say one of the things that was a gift of this retreat was just getting an appreciation of the truth of what wise people have said over the years that our true nature is we tend to be so identified with our minds that we think I am Roger and I am someone who's done this or that, and then we get a chance for spend a few weeks in silence and the mind settles down and we recognize that oh actually I'm not this little self-concept or this little self-image. There's an awareness that is always already present behind that thought and these ideas and those images and this mind. And that's actually what we really are.
Yes.
And that's prior to anything the mind thinks up or any self-image or self-concept or self-story it generates. And the recognition of that, as with so many deep insights, it's not a construction or a creation. It's a recognition that's there. That awareness is there all the time. It's there at this particular minute, and we can all of us recognize at this moment. Oh yes, there is awareness right now, and it's present in each and every moment, and actually, that's what we really are, not the thoughts and images that are flooding our minds usually and carrying us away and getting us lost into and identified with them.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's so I you know some of while the themes are somewhat familiar, it's always just so enriching to hear from someone who's just come from that. To speak. So although I appreciate that it's not easy to put 3 weeks of silence, into a few sentences, I appreciate you offering that.
Well, thank you for the opportunity of doing so. It's actually it was nice to nice to remember that.
And it does seem like, this also relates to the discussion of ethics because there's a certain element that really to live an awakened life, to do right, you have to be awake first, in a sense. And so, to operate from those levels, and it just feels like cultivating that awareness really is an integral aspect or piece of the ethical puzzle.
I think you're right. I would nuance it a little for myself and maybe say instead of an awakened life, because I can't claim to be that or living it, but
Yes.
what I can claim is that I'm trying to live an awakening life. I'm
Yes.
trying to move in that direction and spend a few more moments each day with that remembrance and recognition, with no pretense that that's where I abide most of the time, but what I can claim is that's the direction I want to go. So I can sure claim and hope and pray that I'm living an awakening life.
Yes. Yeah. Well, see, now I have to change the name of the show because that just sounds so much more appropriate.
Maybe, I don't know, that's something all of us can aspire to.
Certainly. And what you said earlier about it being bottomless, I think in one sense there's this idea of awakening as, okay, I've awakened. It's sort of that always already aspect of it. That this awareness that I've awoken to has always been there. In a sense, some Adyashanti speaks to this sometimes of just the idea
Yeah,
that we're always awake.
or that awareness is always there. Anyway, yeah, he's very good on that. He's one of my favorite teachers these days, I have to say.
Yeah, I agree. And they call it the direct approach, his approach. But I also appreciate that, there is this unfolding process that is, if you buy into the Buddhist doctrine that form is not other than emptiness and emptiness is not other than form, then this unfolding is just as sacred as what it's unfolding from and into. And
Oh,
so
that's very, wait, I went on. I want to look that one in. That was very nicely said.
Oh.
That's a great sentence.
Well, thank you. Coming from you, that definitely means a lot. Well, it seems that yeah, that was just the idea of an evolutionary enlightenment, that this sort of ecstatic urge really is, this part of us that's reaching, really is, as holy as the part that is abiding or holding. So yeah, it just, yeah, I just was inspired by the idea of an awakening life versus an awakened life.
That speaks for me better than awakened life, because awakened life just isn't, I mean, I can acknowledge someone like an Adyashanti who I think does come from that place, but
Yes.
he's one of, a handful of people at best
Yes.
that I know of who do live, it seems like, continuously in that place, and I've looked very hard for them.
Yes.
So it's not something I can claim, an awakened life, and I don't think, and Adyashanti himself would be very clear, he draws the distinction, as you know, between abiding and non-abiding awakening,
Yeah.
and warns very clearly that abiding awakening is very, very, very
Yes.
rare. And so it's not something I can, speak of or claim in any way, but I can, I think all of us can claim to be aiming for an awakening life.
Yes. I mean, some people, I've had this discussion, with a few people before about, what, degrees of awakening and how do you define that and how do you, even talk about that. And some people say, well, or is it from the morning you wake up to the morning you go to sleep? And then some people say, well, no, Ramana Maharshi, for example, I mean, said that, that which isn't present in deep dreamless sleep isn't real. And so, that deep dreamless sleep appeared to be his abiding, or the, I'm not saying this exactly the way that I want to, but,
It was continuous. That kind of awareness is available behind all states. It's Turiya in his tradition,
yes.
the fourth consciousness behind waking, dreaming, and non-dream sleep.
Yes. So yeah, it seems like most of us are awakening to and aspiring to this, and those that, and fortunately there are those that are here among us that have done the hard work and let go to the point where, we could say they have an that sort of abiding, awakening or awakened presence. Huh. Gosh.
Yeah, well, bless him.
Yeah, bless them.
And thank you.
Yeah, amen. Amen to that. Well, Roger, I just, this has been of course, a very enlightening discussion, and I really appreciate your willingness to take the time to talk to me today about, your experience with the course and living ethically, and yes, yeah, just really been a pleasure.
It really has for me too. Thank you so much for this opportunity and the chance to dialogue like this. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, my pleasure. Hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Great.
All right, take care, Roger.
Thanks so much.
Yep.